Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
My guest today is Denny Rancourt, Professor Denny Rancourt. Denny is a distinguished, tenured professor of physics. He's a recognized expert in his field. He's also an environmental science researcher, formerly at the University of Ottawa. Denny can talk about that during the program. Despite all these credentials, including his tenure, which is sort of like an academic bulletproof vest, well, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, whether it's in America, whether it's in Canada, and if it doesn't work in those two places, maybe it doesn't work most anywhere. As a result, Denny was unjustly persecuted and fired by the university, barred from campus, a gross violation of his academic freedom, his tenure, his stature, his support for human rights, civil liberties, and equal justice. You know, in the world we live in today, those are the kind of things that when people support them, especially when they become prominent supporting them, it can get you in a lot of trouble. Now, if you support the empire, you can do anything you want. You can support lawlessness. They may even give you a grant. But if you stand up for right over wrong, you could end up in lots of trouble. And it happened to Denny, and it's happened to too many other people I can think of, and we could talk all day about that topic. Let me mention one thing, and Denny, my apologies to you. I seem to get so engrossed in what I was doing this morning, I forgot to mention that if we're able to do it, I would like to have a short segment with a gentleman who is in Tripoli right now. He's also someone who's a distinguished writer and a good friend of mine, Marty Nazimroya. He is in Tripoli having internet connection problems. I don't know whether he would have a telephone connection problem, but if we can reach him, it could be very spotty. Then we'll get him on the phone for a short update of what's going on based on his perspective. He's been there for a few days now, and he'll be there for a few weeks or longer, reporting honestly on what's going on the ground. It's not what the U.S. and I imagine the Canadian media are reporting. It's certainly not what the New York Times reports that I monitor on a daily basis. What they say and what is reality are far removed. Denny, I welcome you to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here, Steve.
Oh, it's great to have you, Denny.
Thanks for having me.
Let me just check to see if we reach. Did we reach Marty? No, we have not reached Marty. Denny, I had a couple of weeks ago, I had on Cynthia McKinney, the former congresswoman. She was also in Tripoli for some weeks, and we finally reached her after about 30 minutes of trying. It is not easy going into a war zone and trying to just call somebody and get them on the telephone lickety-split, if at all, and it worries me what could be going on during, if in fact I do connect, whether we might hear some background sound effects that I would prefer not to hear. But Denny, I welcome you. Let's jump into what you and I want to talk about, and it's the things that you've been involved with, and you have a website, UFO Watch. Maybe you could tell our listeners about that.
Well, okay. Maybe I could start by commenting on some of the things you said in the introduction. Because, you know, you mentioned that when we support right over wrong, we can get into trouble. And I certainly agree with that, but I would add something to that. And I would say that you only get into trouble as a university professor doing that if you do it in such a way that truly threatens local authorities or the establishment. In other words, you can write, you know, wonderful critiques and publish them on the web and in journals and so on, do all kinds of things like that, but never get into trouble. And I think a really good example of that is Noam Chomsky. I think Noam Chomsky writes deep critical essays and exposes things very, very well, and is just a brilliant researcher and someone who's able to interpret how the system functions and what it is motivated by and so on. So it gives us a great insight into understanding how the world works and how that might relate to us more locally. But if you, as long as you do it in that way without actually threatening local authorities and local people and institutions that control our lives, if you don't threaten these institutions, then you're not going to get into trouble, except in the rare cases where some powerful individuals just, develop a personal antagonism towards you. There are cases like that which are purely personal psychology, but they're rare. But generally speaking, if you're not directly threatening these institutions at your place of work, where you're connected to the economy, you don't get into trouble.
Denny, I absolutely agree with you, and that's a very important addition to what I said. Surprisingly, Noam taught at MIT, of all places, and MIT is very generously endowed with all kinds of military Pentagon money or defense contractor money or both to pursue exactly the kind of things that I know he's against and you and I are against. But he is a professor emeritus there now, and he's getting up in years. I think he's in his early 80s now. And surprisingly, he got away with one thing that other professors have not gotten away with, and you can comment on your own experience. He has written some very, very critical analyses of the way Israel persecutes the Palestinians. And he wrote a marvelous book. If I can get the title right, I read it years ago. Just a marvelous book. It's a classic on Israel, Palestine, and America. Oh my goodness! I want. It's sort of.
Yeah.
It's sort of a,
well, that is true. I mean, there's a degradation. There's a gray zone there that we have to talk about. You know, in the U.S., the whole Israel lobby question is very sensitive and touches directly the power structure of the United States and its influence in the Middle East. So that is going to be one of these areas where, even if you're not directly challenging the institutions, like the lobby itself and so on, you could still get into trouble. But again, I find that, you know, Noam is very careful. Noam Chomsky is very careful. He will write these broad analyses about the geopolitics of the conflict and the economic military relationships between the United States and Israel and so on. He'll do that, but he won't locally attack, you know, as a Jewish professor, attack the Israel lobby right there where he lives and in his country and go after them and personally, you know, in what they're doing and how they're doing it and the intellectual dishonesty that's involved in that and so on. He won't actually personalize his defense for Palestinian rights. So he does it. I think it's relatively safe to keep your analysis on the broad geopolitical front. You get into trouble, as I was saying earlier, when you are starting to be effective, when you're using your authority and your reputation to go after the reputations and the societal authority of others who are doing wrong things. That's when you get into trouble. And I think that Noam Chomsky doesn't do that. He does critique intellectuals who he feels, don't have a strong enough, rigorous enough academic analysis and so on. He can be very harsh towards intellectuals, but I've never seen him actually go after powerful sort of local or national authorities. I mean, he'll criticize in a historic sense past presidents and so on. He'll say satirical things about them and so on, but I've never seen him actually go after people. And I think that's the line that when you cross it, you get into some real trouble because you make real local enemies in your environment that go after you.
Oh, absolutely right. And the title of the book I was trying to think of was it's a classic book. I recommend it to anybody, and I think it's come out in a number of updated editions. I don't know what the most recent one is, but the book is called Fateful Triangle: the United States, Israel, and the Palestinians. And it really is it's a remarkable work. It really is remarkable. It's very long, very detailed. And if the newest edition is anywhere near updated, I'm certain he hasn't done it in at least a few years. But it truly is a remarkable work that is worth anybody's trouble reading if you want to understand the relationship among those three countries. But I think you're right. He'll go so far, but no further.
Well, that's the thing. You see, even this wonderful book that you're talking about is great if you want to intellectually understand, as someone who is practicing geopolitical analysis, you know, as a citizen who is interested in that topic, in the same way you'd be interested in stamp collecting or something else, you know, if you're trying to just understand how the world works. I mean, through stamps you can get a lot of history, you can find out about power battles and so on. You know, you can do that through stamps as well. I know I'm being mean, but I really believe that if we're going to change things, we have to act locally against the powerful institutions that control our lives. And I want to give a detailed example with regards to Israel. I mean, one of the ways that Israel is getting away with its crimes, and you know this in great detail, is that they're trying to legitimize their image. They have a campaign that they pour a lot of funds into that's called Brand Israel. And this campaign extends throughout the world, throughout the developed world. And even in Ottawa, where I live, you know, this small town, which is the capital of Canada, at my university, the University of Ottawa, you can see the functioning of Brand Israel in the sense that there are ties between the president of the university and Israel lobby groups that will try to create academic exchange programs between Israeli universities and Canadian universities. You know, in opposition to the boycott and divestment international call against Israel's war crimes. So this is happening, and the way that you can fight it locally is when these programs start to come into effect at the university, people within academia that are at the Senate, the University Senate, that are on the Board of Governors, that can influence these players on these bodies, can question the academic value of this new program and what was the political motivation for this program and who is funding it and why and all of these things. And that is being done very effectively at the University of Ottawa thanks to a very dedicated student senator by the name of Joseph Hickey, who has been the only senator, you know, really with a backbone, and who has insisted on asking the right questions and digging into things and exposing what is going on. Because the Senate's real function, its statutory purpose, has been diverted by the executive, which in turn has ties with the Israel lobby. And it diverts it away from the highest authority at the university that can define academic programs for academic reasons, into an instrument that just participates in these campaigns to legitimize Israel. So that's where the real battles are, I think, because if you can change the, I'll use an expression from the U.S. military, the hearts and minds locally in the Ottawa community about what the University of Ottawa is doing in legitimizing a war criminal state, then you're having a real effect. Then you're effectively countering this mind wash called Brand Israel that is trying to get us to accept the horrendous violations of the Geneva Conventions that are being perpetrated constantly by Israel and so on, right? So you see my point. You can write about these things from a broad geopolitical perspective, or you can actually say, well, how does this affect me at my place of work in the institutions that I'm involved with? What can I do about it concretely? Can I take these guys on? Of course, it's much higher risk for the individual when you try to do that. Back to Chomsky, I mean, he explained this with regards to Norman Finkelstein's work. he actually publicly says that he told Norman Finkelstein, you know, if you do this, you're going to be going against this powerful lobby and all the intellectuals that are tied to it. And so for your career and for your own survival, you maybe don't want to do that. That's what he was implying. So it kind of shows where he's at with that, you know. I much more highly respect someone who directly confronts these lies with themes like, you know, the Holocaust industry and calls it what it is and is talking about locally, the powers locally and how they're behaving, than someone who does broad geopolitical analysis and avoids those things because it could be dangerous to your career.
Denny, there's no question in the world. I agree with everything you said, and in my own way, I don't specifically try to take on a university or all universities, but I hold back nothing on this program in any interviews that I have and in the articles that I write, and I turn out a fair number of them. I've got a new article that I'll put out tomorrow. I've written a lot about the horrendous conditions in Israeli prisons in their treatment of Palestinians. They literally represent hell on earth in the worst sense, the way these people are treated. And they're treated this way not because they're criminals, it's because they want Palestine to be free again. And that's called a resistance. That is not called a terrorist activity, but that's not the way Israel interprets it. That's not the way America interprets it, et cetera. And so my article for tomorrow is, despite all the harshness going on in Israeli prisons, Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, what can I call him, a despicable character, to say the least. He wants to make the conditions in Israeli's prisons for Palestinians, for security prisoners, he says. I don't know what he means by a security prisoner. Does that mean anybody who wants a free Palestine? I guess so. He wants to make mean and nasty conditions even tougher. And he made a few comments, and I quote him in my articles and go through this a little bit, and then I spent a fair amount of time explaining what goes on in these prisons, not just to men, to children as young as 10 years old, some even younger at times, not really, but occasionally. I mean, they'll actually get a 10-year-old and torture the kid, isolate him from his parents, give him no contact with the outside world for whatever amount of time they want to hold him. They usually won't put a 10-year-old away for 10 years in prison. But the only offense they charge these kids with are throwing rocks, if they even did it. Throwing rocks that should get you in prison. I mean, even if you hit somebody and maybe gave them a bruise,
they're usually not throwing rocks against somebody. It's against a tank, an armored vehicle, and things like that, right?
Oh, exactly. or Israeli soldiers brutalizing them.
Yeah.
And, you know, in response to a rock being thrown, Israeli soldiers just might open fire and kill a kid, shoot kids in the head or the chest or the back or whatever. And, you know, it doesn't make any difference. Or they'll raid homes and they'll haul kids out in the middle of the night. The parents are frantic. They have no idea what's going on. They will intimidate these kids. They'll beat them. They'll threaten them with rape. Sometimes they'll torture them. And they can hold them for several days, maybe several weeks. And some of these kids come back home again so traumatized that it could take considerable psychotherapy to restore them to their normal childhood. And Israel does this brutally. I think they also have the death penalty in place for children. Now, that's illegal under international law, but Israel pays no attention not only to international law, to its own laws. It has no constitution, but it has basic laws, and they talk about human rights and civil liberties. Well, they may practice them for Jews, Denny, but anybody who is not a Jew in Israel is committing the crime of not being Jewish.
Speaking things exactly how you see them, truth as you understand it, and that is wonderful. I think you're doing a great job. I'm very inspired when I hear you speak in such, you know, unqualified terms about what you see. But at the same time, I'm because of the theme of the show today, where we're talking about local actions and institutions and so on, I want to challenge you about something. Do you want to take up the challenge?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I'm going to suggest, like, in your local environment, you are tied to a Jewish community, and that Jewish community has opinions and outlooks and interpretations, maybe doesn't always appreciate your outlook. How do you interact with your community locally in order to attempt to at least challenge them with regards to their beliefs and so on?
I honestly don't have particular context with the local Jewish community, and Chicago is a very, very large city with dozens and dozens of suburbs, so there's a downtown community, I'm sure. Oh, there are a good many Jews in my building. I have had one-on-one conversations with a number of them. There is one in particular who he and I are absolutely in sync on these things, and we exchange emails on them. I've said these things to others. I even offered once in my building, Denny, if the building didn't go along with it, the building is very, very staid and conservative, I offered to have a meeting and have a discussion with others in my building, not only on this issue, but on virtually any other major world and national issue. Anybody who might want to attend this meeting would bring up, and I would be willing to stay there as long as they wanted. We could do it for an hour. We could do it for a morning or an afternoon. We could do it for the entire day. We could just keep this thing going as long as they wanted me. And there are people in my building I know do not share my point of view, but I would present the facts as I know them, as honestly as I can.
But how did they receive your invitation? Was there such a meeting?
No, there was no meeting. I think the way my building operates, it's a very large condominium building, and they have all kinds of diverse people living in it. But I think the way the building operates is they don't want to bring up, shall I say, controversial topics for public discussion or whatever. We have a building newsletter that goes out once a month, and the person, or the woman who prepares this, contacted me once. She said she wanted to do a write-up about me. Well, I was amazed. This was before I really got into my writing. I was just beginning to do it, and I'm not sure if she really knew much about what I was doing. She had to have known something to want to get me to do it. She stopped me at the elevator one day. And
but
she said,
what was an article published as a result of that?
No. Then she changed her mind. She said, I have a few other people that I have to take care of, but I want to write
right.
you up. She asked me to send her something. I
right.
sent her a brief blurb about myself, and she never contacted me. And then I got back to her and said, are we still going to do this? And she said to me, I forget how she worded it, but something to the extent that the building does not want to address controversial things like I do. Anything that should be in this newsletter should be apolitical.
Right. But you see, Stephen, to continue my line of challenging you, you are describing, you made tentative forays into trying to get a discourse going and to challenge different opinions and points of view and to compare yours with those in your environment, the people in your environment, but they were not by any means successful. In other words, you were blocked at every step. The editor of this condominium journal blocked you. You weren't able to organize a meeting. Nobody showed up. My point is that in terms of locally what you can do, that's where you're being stopped, and I would use the word oppressed. You know, you're not being allowed to have agency in your immediate local environment. And so on the local front, one would have to ask, well, what can you do in order to get that moving? And what can you do in order to start to have that real impact on real people that are closest to you That's the next question.
You know, you leave me with an interesting thought, Denny. We have a brand new building manager. I have not met her yet. The manager that we had, a man in his 50s, a very decent guy, shockingly, several weeks ago, he went home on a Friday, and over the weekend he had a heart attack and died. I think it was over the weekend. On Monday, the staff came in and discovered that the manager had died. So there's a new manager. She's only 1 week into the job. I want to go down and introduce myself, which I'll do. I didn't want to do it the first few days she was there. She's still feeling her way around this place, although she's not new to property management. She's new to this building. But I wanted to go down and introduce myself. I will raise this subject with her and tell her I very much would like to do it, and explain that I have a public stage, and I do this not just in writing, but I do it vocally, on the air, on my own program, in many interviews that I get, and I get a wonderful reader and listener response. People enjoy hearing the truth about important things because they can't turn on their television set. They can't pick up the morning newspaper and get this kind of information. And I would think
how does one change the opinions of a community with regards to their position, which you come to believe is wrong, about something as important as, you know, the kinds of genocidal policies that are being pursued by Israel?
Well,
how does one do that?
I can give you the answer. I have an MBA in marketing many years ago, class of 1960. And I would say that you need to reach a fair-sized target audience, and the power of repetition, Denny. You know, it's like if you want to sell something and you run an ad in the newspaper selling Brand X or whatever it is, oh, you might get a few bites, but the way to really sell your Brand X is you have to take out a lot of ads. You have to keep doing it. And that's what the big corporate people do in advertising their products and services. They keep repeating them over and over and over and over again in your face. If you don't put your TV set on mute when commercials come on, you're drowning on these commercials that can run 5 minutes on end, one after another.
So I understand that is the social change model that you are using. I can see it in your work, and you're trying to do that, and you write an awful lot of articles, and you do an awful lot of interviews, and you get out there as much as you can. And I think that's the social change model that you're using. You're hoping to have an influence, an agency within society through that mechanism, right?
Oh, yeah. And I understand very well, Denny, that I'm one person. And compared to the major broadcasters, cable channels, I certainly don't reach their sized audiences. But I discovered, Denny, just a remarkable discovery, because a common question people ask is, concerned people ask, I think I understand the problems, but I'm only one person, what can I do? And my answer is always the same. Well, I'm only one person, and look what I'm doing. You don't have to do what I'm doing. Everybody can do something. Everybody.
Right.
And it simply doesn't matter. The idea is to do something. Don't think about it. Don't talk about it. Do it. Anything.
But the doing that you're talking about mostly is communicating these ideas in order to create a space where these competing opinions can have a chance to get through to people. That's the doing that you're talking about. But there's another kind of doing, I think, that's I would argue, more important. And that is the doing where you use your body and your voice and your influence and your authority in the community and so on in order to directly challenge the opinions that are keeping us and the system inactive and therefore condoning these crimes. And so, in other words, in your face, but personally, to maybe not your immediate neighbors, but to, you know, you have to decide how much you're going to risk. And there's definite real risk involved because you're talking about your relationship to your community. But I think that's where the tension has to be in order to create change. One has to be actually risking by pushing back and fighting against what is oppressing you. For example, you're being limited in your ability to do this by these rules. This example, you know, it has to be apolitical. Well, that is another way of saying it has to be political, strictly political, in that it does not challenge the status quo. There's no such thing as apolitical. When someone says apolitical, they really mean completely controlled, censored, and political. That's what it means, right?
Oh,
so you're being directly oppressed in that way, and then I think one has to fight that oppression and challenge that and find ways, like which committee controls the editorial policy of this publication, and why did the policy become that, and what does it mean, what's its origin, and who can you challenge in order to change it, and so on and so on. You see what I'm doing?
Oh, absolutely. The publication is run by this one woman, not a committee. And of course, the building is run by the property manager outside of the building, and they can run it the way they want. It's the same, example, Denny, say, for me to get on broadcast television. I know somebody who is trying to get me on a couple of big TV programs, and run by people with hosts who are a little bit more to the center or left of center than the crazies on Fox News or the most extreme ones that show up on U.S. television. And the overture sent to these people was very, very nice. It gave me a write-up, much more than I would deserve to have anybody say about me. So far, no bites. You know, I want to do all these things. I can't force these people to give me airtime. I can only keep trying, keep chipping away, and hope that maybe I would have a chance to get a greater public voice, to make a greater impact. That music means we need to take a quick break.
Okay, just so I know, we're taking a break, but we're continuing for until the end of the hour?
Oh, exactly. We got the full hour.
Okay.
Okay, Denny, we'll be right back.
Okay.
Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for all things progressive.
Have you heard? The Burt Cohen Show brings you the hidden truths behind the stories that affect us all and gives you the information you need to build freedom, community, and a much better world. This is Burt Cohen. My past shows include The New Media Power of Comcast, Socialism for Wall Street Only, and How to Empower Your Own Community Over Corporate Interests. For archives, go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and listen to The Burt Cohen Show every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. The Burt Cohen Show. There's really nothing like it.
Nikki, I'm so excited to be on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll be able to talk to you live, answer your questions, and work with you for your own patient rights. Tune in every Sunday at 5 p.m. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you on Sunday, 5 p.m.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. Every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for all things progressive.
His name marks the beginning of a beautiful friendship, because the stronger my heart gets, the stronger my pen gets.
Back on with Professor Denny Rancourt, University of Ottawa up in Canada, and Denny can talk about his own experience a little bit more in the second half of the program. Denny, I absolutely agree with everything you say. Of course, we are just plain citizens, and we're going up against a very powerful nation state, you in Canada, myself here in America. It's not an easy struggle. My feeling has always been that winning, that the way to take them on is not to battle them head on head. You know, their power against our non-power, but really try to reach people at the grassroots and have influence there and spread information, get people aroused. And my feeling there has always been that winning the battle starts with information. If people don't understand the problem, I mean understand it enough to know that what's going on is really harming them directly, and secondly, to understand the only way to change this is for grassroots action. That's the only way big change has ever come. I repeat that all the time on this program. Listeners may be tired of hearing it, but they know it's true.
But what is an example of an effective grassroots action?
Oh, I've
just let's concentrate on one example.
I'll give you the best example I know.
Okay.
In America, ending slavery. That was thought to be impossible at one time. But
that's a result of many actions. But what is an example of a concrete action that you're referring to?
Well, there was an agenda to end a heinous system. So that's what I'm referring to. You mean a specific example of what somebody did to end slavery?
Well, yeah, or something maybe more recent, but an example of an action. Because you used the word action.
You challenge me to scratch my head. I know one thing that I feel doesn't get much in the way of results at all, and that's to go out in the street and protest. There are lots of protests, anti-war protests, protests for immigrant rights. In my own city, Chicago, there have been a lot of these actions. They do nothing. They do nothing.
Okay, so that's an example of an action that appears to be ineffective. Do you have an example of an action that would be effective?
Well, I can think of something that I would like to see done that would be effective. Stop protesting, and instead of lining up in front of the Capitol in Washington or the White House, storm the barricades. Storm the barricades. I absolutely believe in nonviolence, but I also absolutely believe in civil disobedience. And to put it bluntly, Denny, if the bastards are going to keep harming us, then it's up to us to go harm the bastards.
Right. So you're talking about civil disobedience, but in the form of physically with your body crossing a barricade, going in and challenging them with your presence.
Absolutely.
You're talking about that, right? So in the sense of what Gandhi's true pacifism was about, where people would actually go with their bodies, they'd break the law, they'd go where they were told they were not allowed to go, they would do things they were told they were not allowed to do, and they would risk being subjected to violence as a result, and being put in jail and beaten and so on. So you're talking about that very direct kind of civil disobedience pacifism.
Absolutely, and the kind that I remember, and I should have given this as the example, what happened during the civil rights movement in America. This is exactly what was done. People like Martin Luther King and many others, growing numbers, black and white people, this was mostly in the South, and they literally put their bodies up against the system, and the system beat them down terribly, but they wouldn't quit. And I think their numbers grew, and it spread from state to state, and they finally won the day, never perfectly. And very sadly, the gains that were made back in the 1960s are all lost now. And that was explained very well in a book. Again, it's been a good while since I read it, and I forget the exact title. But the idea in the book was that even when you win these gains, unless you keep struggling to hold on to them, the energy wanes, and the other side takes them back incrementally. So in America, Denny, we had a more social America at one time, the New Deal, and even under Harry Truman, the Fair Deal, and then Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. My God, I remember vividly when we got Medicare, where elderly people would be taken care of. Try for an elderly person today without Medicare to get an insurer to give them medical insurance without charging so much they couldn't afford it. But I'm on Medicare. Medicare is badly as they've gone after it to weaken it, it's still a marvelous system. I know the scheme is to end it, destroy it altogether, but as it exists today, weakened from the day I went on it 10 years ago, it's a marvelous system, and but I remember vividly when that came into effect.
So been all lost. It hasn't been all lost yet. There's still remnants like that.
Oh, well, that's a benefit that's still around. The civil rights are lost. That was the example that I'm giving.
Yeah.
The civil rights gains are all lost, and the civil rights leaders in this country admit that openly. They are gone because the energy waned, and the other side just whittled away, and finally the whole thing is just swept away and gone.
Yeah.
Labor rights have eroded the same way. In the 1930s, that was the peak. 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was passed, and for the first time ever, it gave labor the right to bargain on equal terms with management. Well, under Harry Truman, they started to be eroded with the Taft-Hartley Act, and back in the 1950s even, 35% of private workers were unionized, and today it's down to about 7%. And now the bastards are going after public workers, and that's what's going on in Wisconsin, in Ohio, across the country. And unless these people stand up and fight and not quit for their rights, they're going to lose them all. I have a direct action method for fighting back that I think is foolproof if people were courageous enough to do it and stick with it. And the method is general strike. That I wrote about that in Wisconsin. I sent it to some people in the public workers fight that to hold on to their rights.
But Steve, let me interject here. I agree with you completely that the kinds of direct action and civil disobedience where you're actually using your body in the way that you're suggesting, and for example, striking when it's deemed illegal at the risk of going to jail and so on, these are effective methods, especially compared to the completely neutralized methods that we seem to have these days, which are these gutless demonstrations and where people are not prepared to risk. But I don't believe that we can get to a position where we're using these effective methods through information and education and broadcasting that we think these methods would be effective. In other words, I don't believe that people engage and become conscious of what they need to do and start using these effective methods through a process of information and education. I don't believe that information is the first step or is even a useful step to bring people to that stage. I think that's a myth, and I think that they've managed to convince us of that, and therefore we stay in that neutralized place where we're trying to generate what would be effective action, but using a method that will never be able to generate it, which is just to give information and express opinion and try to broadcast and so on and so on. That's the critique that I would put forth today in our social movements.
Then how do we do it, Denny?
Well, I think that the only way that it can be done is that it needs to be catalyzed by direct action itself. In other words, you have to start with those kinds of bold actions, and the first people to do them are going to go to jail and are going to suffer consequences, and then their friends and community are going to rally behind them, and some of them are going to be as bold or bolder, and then you get this kind of chain reaction going. Now, sometimes you do these bold actions and you simply get squashed and nobody stands up for you and you get, you know, put away for a long time, and other times there's a chain reaction that develops. So, but without these kinds of bold actions and without some people feeling sufficiently oppressed that they feel that they have to do this to defend themselves, and actually doing it, then we're not going anywhere. It's not going to happen on its own. It has to happen through learning about it, and you can only learn about it through doing it. In other words, it has to be a knowledge that comes from experience of actually doing it, to see how the system, experience how the system is going to respond. There will be backlash. How you're going to be able to protect yourself despite that backlash, how you're going to be able to respond. So in other words, it becomes a praxis, an actual process of learning through action. And the information only serves to help you in reflecting on that process and to help and to inform that process. But information on its own as a catalyst, I think, is neutralized from the start. It is not a method that leads to social change on its own, as if you intend it to be a catalyst. I don't believe that. In other words, it's got to start with action and the first few brave people, and then see where that leads. And I think the way to start those kinds of actions is for each of us to ask ourselves, where am I oppressed? Where am I really being limited in a way that I feel my humanity and my right to contribute agency to society is being constrained in a significant way, that I feel pressured and stressed from that, and I'm oppressed by it, and that's where I need to fight back, directly where I see it, where they've got their hands around my throat. That's where I need to fight back. Now, how do I do it? Let me see. Let me think of things I can do, and let me try it. And the first things I try might be tentative, might not be terribly successful, or I might not feel that they're successful. And of course, the system is going to constantly try to convince you that what you just did was ineffective and useless. But if you can go beyond that and recognize that, well, if it was so ineffective and useless, then why are they so pissed about it? Why are they so angry? Why is the backlash so tremendous? And if you can, and then you learn through that direct experience to recognize the truth, despite what they're trying to tell you about your own action, and you push forward, and it inspires others, and they join you, and shoulder to shoulder in solidarity, you fight back. I think that that's the recipe for change that has been driven out of us. We've forgotten it, and the history of social change has been rewritten by the establishment, and it has been pacified and neutralized, and it's been sending us in the direction of, you know, information is the answer, education is the answer, organizing, you know, that word is used not to organize for actions, but to organize to give out information, which is useless, I think, on its own, mind you, without praxis, without actually having a plan that you're going to do something effective, the kind of effective that you were just talking about not long ago. So that's what I think works.
Again, I cannot disagree with that, Denny, and I think the great civil rights gains that I remember so well were won by exactly the formula that you're describing.
Yeah.
I mean, people...
Why have we forgotten that? Why are so many progressives, so-called activists, in this mythological space where they believed that education and organizing to educate and information is going to change the world and is going to give us justice and effective action. Never has that happened in the history of humankind. Why would that be true now?
Again, that's exactly right. I think the only time that you might get some degree of spontaneity is one of the thoughts floating around in my mind, and I've shared this with a few other people. If conditions economically get so bad that enough people literally are not certain where the next meal is coming from, and if they happen to have children they're very concerned about, if it gets to that state and they literally see their government thumbing their nose, doing nothing, and at the same time in America especially, spending all of this money fighting foreign wars without end, it's possible at some point that could ignite a fuse and really stimulate some sort of a mass revolt.
Well, we
haven't seen it in this country.
No. But
the possibility is there.
Yeah, but Steve, I don't believe this idea that if you have physical hardship, it improves the conditions for the probability of people fighting back and defending themselves. I don't believe that. I know that it's a very common social theory, but there are so many examples in history. You know, well, broad organized slavery, for example, you know, for decades on end, people, a large population of slaves will accept slavery and will justify it to themselves and will develop a culture to survive within that. So, and that's true of wage slavery as well in our society. You know, we completely give up all the creative hours of our day to an employer and we accept it and we justify it and we normalize it. So I don't think that having our dignity and our humanity removed from us and the physical hardship is enough on its own to create responses, effective responses. So I think it's a cultural thing, and there needs to be an awakening, and that awakening comes through these sparks of action. And they can be maintained. For example, with regards to America, I think conditions can get very harsh, but people won't fight back. And when I see who is fighting back in America in a real effective way, it tends to be the right more than the left. The left are still in this model of information will save us, whereas the right is much more guttural and visceral, and they will not stand for certain things. You know, they draw a line in the sand. And politicians understand that. So it might happen on the right. I don't know. But I think the world is going to be made more sane, not starting in the gut of the American empire, but because the rest of the world is resisting and is fighting back. And I'm thinking of Latin America, where the resistance to American domination is tremendous. It's organized. It has deep cultural roots. Those are the things that are going to transform America. The fact that America will not be able to, because the only way that America is funding these wars is by exploiting for natural and labor resources the rest of the world. You need real resources. Forget the paper economy. If you're going to be building a war machine and having wars everywhere, you need real resources and real materials, and you need to the extent, and it's such a big machine that you need to be stealing it from elsewhere. Well, it's to the extent that the people you're stealing it from are going to resist that the machine is going to be slowed down. Forget the paper economy. Of course, the U.S. can print U.S. dollars as much as it wants, and trillions mean nothing and so on. But there is underlying that a real economy, and there are real people who can resist, who will not put up with it. It's happening in Latin America. It's happening to some degree in the Middle East, and so on, to a large degree. And this is what will slow the empire down, and will ultimately cause the pressures to restructure things to some degree.
That's exactly right, Denny. And I'm thinking of the Middle East, even though I know people talk loosely about the Arab Spring. And I wrote an article I called Arab Spring Yet to Bloom. And very definitely the Arab Spring has yet to bloom. But the courage of those people, they simply won't quit. And if they stay at what they're doing and they want to throw off the repressive governments that are taking everything and giving back nothing. And, of course, America's interest in that region is because of the great resources there, mainly oil and gas. That's the reason that we wage these wars. Iraq and Afghanistan has multiple reasons. Libya, absolutely, is oil is a very big part of Libya, but it's not the only reason.
But there are other reasons that we wage these wars, I think, that are also important.
There are many reasons.
Yeah.
I sum it up in two words, wealth and power, global dominance.
Right.
Imperial dominance, literally to control everybody and to have the leaders of all these countries under America's thumb.
Yes.
So Gaddafi was only 90% under America's thumb. America wants 99.9%, maybe 0.1% wiggle room that they'll give to anybody as long as it isn't on a vital issue that concerns America. But Gaddafi was too independent. Saddam was too independent. Afghanistan was another situation.
Yeah.
Convenient to blame for something that they had absolutely nothing to do with.
But also the Afghanistan, there's additionally a large geopolitical reason in terms of geography.
Right? Oh, absolutely.
Cutting off the energy resources to China from the gas-rich
Caspian area.
Yes, yes.
Oh, very, very definitely, and also to encroach as close to Russia and China's border as possible.
Yes.
Not just Afghanistan, but the former Soviet republics, and that's exactly what's going on. Russia and China hate it. They understand it better than I do, for certain, but they know about it. I've written a little bit about that, one article specifically about it, People in so many of these places, Denny, understand that it seems better than people do here and are willing to do more of what you're talking about, literally put their bodies up against this and say, we want no part of it. And that's the courage that I see in the Middle East. If that energy continues, then I think there could be a good result.
Well, there could in the future be some other kinds of changes that will occur as well. I mean, China and Russia have war technologies that are effective against even the United States, that could potentially be effective. And if they start to distribute those technologies to resisting countries where the U.S. is trying to invade or is occupying and so on in a more aggressive way and start to develop ties with these countries, that could shift a lot of things. That could really start to shift the power balances in a lot of these regions, you know, and that could happen any time, you know. These international agreements and relations, they're fluid, they evolve. Russia once invaded Afghanistan, but, you know, Russia could become an ally of the Taliban. Who knows, right? These kinds of things are in the future, and so it's hard to predict how the world is going to go. I mean, a good recent example of that is what happened in Lebanon when Israel tried to invade it, and they thought it would be just a walk in the park where they would just march in, and all of a sudden their tanks were being blasted to hell because the resistance had real weapons and they couldn't get anywhere, and it was a fiasco. All they could do was bomb from the air. And that really changed Israeli consciousness about their military power in the region. So a lot of things might be in the future, in the coming decade or so, that could shake down the U.S. empire. Because the U.S. empire, in combination with Israel right now, is absolutely vicious. I mean, it's not an accident that world public opinion about Israel and the United States is so low. It's not an accident. You've got 1,000 military bases all over the world. You've got widespread exploitation of peoples on every continent to keep this war machine going. Something's got to give eventually.
something does have to give eventually, Denny. There's no question.
Yeah.
And exactly what will trigger it and what will get it started with more momentum. Maybe you need to try a lot of things, but I agree that putting our bodies up against it, really, even when we pay the consequences, that makes a big difference. Let me end, and I've said this on the I've mentioned this on the program before. One of the great quotes that I love is "Too long to remember in total," but it came from I.F. Stone, and his great quote was, "The only struggles worth fighting are the ones you know you're going to lose." Because if you keep doing it and then others keep doing it, at some point, it's sometime in the future, somebody's going to win, because of everything people did before the winners prevailed. There could be many years in the future, but that's the way the great battles are won. People now putting up their bodies for something they believe in, and then others doing the same thing, and then eventually at some point, people will declare victory because of everything, all the building blocks that went on leading up to that great moment. I can only hope at my advanced age, Denny, I live long enough to see some of that. I, in my own way, I will try to do everything I can. That's a solemn oath that I took. I'm not getting any younger, but I want to get down fighting. I just can't imagine going down any other way.
Well, I want to cheer you on and join you.
Denny, I welcome you. You are a great comrade in a common struggle. We are out of time. The next host wants to get on the air, so I will bid adieu. And, Denny, I hope we can do this again soon.
It's been a great pleasure, and I'll be happy to do it again.
Thank you, Denny. Join us
right.
Next week, next Thursday,
bye-bye.
Of course, 11 a.m., weekends, 1 p.m.